yard to where I stood in the open doorway. She hesitated, sniffing. I didn't turn on the battery lights because with her nose she didn't need them. She looked at the pile of magazines I'd stacked over whatever remained of the big cockroach, and I could see that educated nose of hers vibrating rapidly. Then she looked at the boards covering the well, and something amazing happened. She trotted to the well and started pawing at the boards, making little yipping sounds of excitement.
She remembers, I thought. And the memories must be good because she wants to go again.
I hung the padlock over the latch and pulled the door partway closed, leaving enough light so I could see my way to the well.
Radar, gotta be quiet now. Hush.
The yipping stopped, but not the pawing at the boards. Her eagerness to go down there made me feel better about what was at the end of the underground corridor. And really, why would I feel bad about it? The poppies were beautiful and smelled even better. There was no harm in the shoe woman. She had welcomed me, had comforted me when I broke down, and I wanted to see her again. She wanted to see Radar again, too. And Radar wants to see her, I think.
Down.
Radar looked at me, but stayed on her feet. She peered into the darkness between the boards, back at me, then back at the boards. Dogs find ways to get their points across, and to me this one seemed totally clear.
Hurry up, Charlie.
Radar down. Very reluctantly, she went on her belly, but the moment I moved the boards from parallel to a V-shape, she was up and running down the steps, fleet as a puppy. There were patches of white on the back of her head and the base of her spine, near the tail. I saw those, and then she was gone. I had been worried about getting her down the steps. That was pretty funny, wasn't it? As Mr. Neville, my English teacher, was fond of saying, irony, it's good for your blood. 2. I almost called for her to come back, then realized it was a terrible idea. She probably wouldn't pay any attention. If she did and tried to turn around on those small steps, she'd almost certainly fall to her death. All I could do was hope she didn't miss her footing in the dark and fall to her death anyway. Or start barking. That would undoubtedly send any lurking jumbo cockroaches packing, but it would startle the bats, also jumbo-sized, into flight. There was nothing I could do about it anyway. All I could do was follow the plan. I descended the steps until I only stuck out from head to chest, with the boards once more in a V-shape and close on either side of me. I began placing tied bundles of magazines on them, walling myself in. All the time I was doing it, I listened for a thud and a final cry of pain, or if the fall didn't kill her, many cries as she lay on the packed dirt, dying by inches because of my bright ideas. I was sweating like a pig as I pulled the boards close around me. I wriggled my arms up through the enclosing wall of magazines and grabbed one more bundle. I balanced it on my head like a tribal woman carrying a load of wash to the nearest river, then bent, slowly. The last bundle came to rest on the hole I'd left. It landed slightly askew, but it would have to serve. If Andy just gave the shed a cursory look before locking up, it would. Of course, that left the question of how I was going to get out of the shed again, but that was a worry for another day. I started down the steps, once again keeping my shoulder against the curve of the wall and the beam of the flashlight trained on my feet. The pack made it slow going. I counted steps again, and when I got to 100, I shone the light down the remainder of the shaft. 2 eerie spots of light shone back up at me as the beam hit the reflective surface dogs have at the back of their eyes. She was down. She was okay, and she was waiting instead of running off down the corridor. The relief I felt was enormous. I got to the bottom as fast as I could, which wasn't very, because I didn't want to be the one lying there with a broken leg. Or two. I dropped to a knee and gave Radar a hug. She was perfectly willing to be hugged under ordinary circumstances, but this time she pulled away almost at once and turned toward the corridor.
Okay, but don't scare the wildlife. Hush.
She went ahead of me, not running, but walking fast, and with no sign of a limp, at least yet. I wondered again exactly what the miracle pills were and how much they were taking away while they were giving. One of my father's sayings was, "There's no such thing as a free lunch." When we neared the place I thought of as the borderland, I risked disturbing the bats to raise the flashlight beam from the floor so I could watch her reaction. What I saw was nothing at all, and I was wondering if that effect wore off after one's initial exposure when that same lightheadedness swam through me. That sense of having an out-of-body experience. It passed as rapidly as it came, and shortly thereafter I saw the spark of light where the corridor opened onto the hillside. I caught up with radar. I brushed through the overhanging vines and looked down on the poppies. Red carpet, I thought. Red carpet. We were in the other world. 3. For a moment, radar stood perfectly still, head forward, ears cocked, nose going. Then she started down the path at a trot, which was now the best speed she could make, or so I thought. I was halfway down the hill when Dora came out of her little cottage with a pair of slippers in one hand. Raids was maybe 10 feet in front of me. Dora saw us coming, more properly saw who was coming on 4 feet instead of 2, and dropped the slippers. She fell to her knees and held out her arms. Radar broke into a full-out run, barking joyously. She pulled up a little at the end, or her aging rear legs did, but not enough to keep from slamming into Dora, who tumbled over on her back with her skirt flying up from her bright green stockings. Radar straddled her, barking and licking her face. Her tail wagged furiously. I broke into a run myself, the loaded pack thumping up and down on my back. I ducked under a line of dangling shoes and grabbed Radar's collar. "Quit it, girl, get off her." But that wasn't going to happen right away because Dora had her arms around Radar's neck and was hugging her head against her bosom, much as she had done for me. Her feet, clad in the same red shoes, with the green stockings her look was quite Christmassy, kicked up and down, doing a happy dance. When she sat up, I saw there was the faintest touch of dull color in those gray cheeks, and gummy liquid, surely all she could manage for tears, was spilling from her narrow, lashless eyes. "Hey!" she cried, and hugged my dog again. Radar went to work licking her neck, tail whipping back and forth.
"Hey, hey, hey."
"I guess you guys know each other," I said. 4. I didn't have to break into my supplies. She fed us and fed us well. The stew was the best I'd ever eaten, loaded with meat and potatoes, swimming in savory gravy. It crossed my mind, probably influenced by some horror movie or other, that we might be eating human flesh, but then I dismissed the idea as ridiculous. This woman was good. I didn't need to see a jolly expression or kindly eyes to know. It radiated from her. And if I didn't trust that, there was the way she had greeted Radar. And, of course, the way Radar had greeted her. I got my own hug when I helped her to her feet, but not like the one she'd given Raids. I kissed her cheek, which seemed perfectly natural. Dora patted me on the back and pulled me inside. The cottage was a single large room and toasty warm. There was no fire in the fireplace, but the stove was going full out, with the pot of stew simmering on a flat metal plate, what I believe is called a hob, although I could be wrong about that. There was a wooden table in the middle of the room with a vase of poppies in the center. Dora set out 2 white bowls that looked handmade and 2 wooden spoons. She gestured for me to sit down. Radar curled up as close to the stove as she could get without singeing her fur. Dora got another bowl from one of the cupboards and used the pump hanging over the kitchen sink to fill it with water. She set it down for Radar, who lapped eagerly, but, I noticed, without lifting her hindquarters from the floor, which wasn't a good sign. I had been careful to ration her exercise, but when she'd seen her old friend's house, nothing could have held her back. If she'd been on the leash, which was stowed in my pack, she would have jerked it out of my hand. Dora put a tea kettle on, served out the stew, then bustled back to the stove. She took mugs from the cupboard, like the bowls, they were rather lumpy, and a jar from which she spooned tea. Ordinary tea, I hoped, not something that would get me stoned. I felt stoned enough already. I kept thinking that this world was somehow below my world. It was a hard idea to shake because I'd gone down to get here, and yet there was sky above. I felt like Charlie in Wonderland, and if I'd looked out the cottage's round front window and seen the Mad Hatter bopping along the road out there, maybe with a grinning Cheshire cat on his shoulder, I wouldn't have been surprised. Or rather, more surprised. The strangeness of the situation didn't change how hungry I was. I'd been too nervous to eat much breakfast. Still, I waited until she brought the mugs and sat down. This was ordinary politeness, of course, but I also thought she might want to say some sort of a prayer, a huzzy-buzzy version of "Bless this food we are about to eat." She didn't, just picked up her spoon and gestured for me to dig in. As I said, it was delicious. I fished out a chunk of meat and showed it to her, raising my eyebrows. The crescent of her mouth turned up in her version of a smile. She put two fingers above her head and hopped a little in her seat. "Rabbit!" She nodded and made a grating, gurgling sound. I realized she was laughing, or trying to, and it made me sad, the same way I felt when I saw someone blind or a person in a wheelchair who was never going to walk again. Most people like that don't want pity. They cope with their disabilities, help others live good lives. They're brave. I get all that, yet it seemed to me, maybe because everything in my personal system was working 5x5, that there was something mean about having to deal with such things out of whack and unfair. I thought of a girl I went to elementary school with, Georgina Womack. She had a huge strawberry birthmark on one cheek. Georgina was a cheerful little thing, smart as a whip, and most kids treated her decently. Birdie Bird used to trade lunchbox stuff with her. I thought she would make her way in life, but I was sorry she had to look at that mark on her face in the mirror every day. It wasn't her fault, and it wasn't Dora's fault that her laugh, which should have been beautiful and free, sounded like an ill-tempered growl. She gave a final hop, as if for emphasis, then made a twirling gesture at me with her finger. "Eat, eat." Radar struggled up, and when she finally got her back legs under her, she came to Dora. The woman slapped the heel of her gray hand against her gray forehead in a "what was I thinking" gesture. She found another bowl and put some meat and gravy in it. She looked at me, scant eyebrows lifted. I nodded and smiled. "Everybody eats at the House of Shoes." Dora gave me her upturned crescent of a smile and set the bowl down. Radar got busy, tail wagging. I scoped out the other half of the room while I ate. There was a neatly made bed, just the right size for a little shoe woman, but most of that side was a workshop, or maybe a rehab unit for wounded shoes. A lot of them had busted backs, or soles that were hanging down from the uppers like broken jaws, or holes in the soles or toes. There was a pair of leather work boots that had been slit down the backs, as if they had been inherited by someone whose feet were bigger than those of the original owner. A crooked wound in a silk bootie of royal purple had been stitched up with dark blue thread, probably the closest Dora had for a match. Some shoes were dirty, and some, on a workbench, were in the process of being cleaned and polished with stuff in small metal pots. I wondered where they'd all come from, but I wondered even more about the object that held pride of place in the workshop half of the cottage. Meanwhile, I'd emptied my bowl and Radar had emptied hers. Dora took them and raised her eyebrows in another question. "Yes, please," I said. "Not too much for Radar or she'll sleep all day." Dora put her clasped hands to the side of her head and closed her eyes. She pointed at Radar. "Knees?" Dora shook her head and did the pantomime again.
"Knees."
"She needs to sleep." The shoe woman nodded and pointed to where Radar had been by the stove. She slept there before? When Mr. Bowditch brought her? Dora nodded again and dropped to one knee to pet Radar's head. Raids looked up at her with, I could be wrong, but I don't think so, adoration. We finished our second bowls of stew. I said thank you. Radar said it with her eyes. While Dora cleared away our bowls, I got up to look at the object in the shoe hospital that had caught my attention. It was an old-fashioned sewing machine, the kind that runs by pumping a treadle. Written on its black casing in fading gold leaf was the word Singer. Did Mr. Bowditch bring you this? She nodded, patted her chest, lowered her head. When she looked up, her eyes were wet. He was good to you. She nodded. And you were good to him. Also to Radar. She made an effort and produced a single, understandable word.
Yes.
You surely have a lot of shoes. Where do you get them? And what do you do with them? She didn't seem to know how to reply to that, and the gestures she made didn't help. Then she brightened and went to the workshop. There was a wardrobe which must have contained her clothes, and a great many more cupboards than in the kitchen half of the cottage. I assumed she stored her various shoe repair equipment in them. She bent to one of the lower ones and brought out a little chalkboard, like the kind a child might have used in the old days of one-room schools and desks with inkwells. She rummaged further and came up with a stub of chalk. She pushed aside some of her works in progress on the workbench, wrote slowly, then held the chalkboard up for me to read. YUSEEGOOGIR. I don't understand. She sighed, rubbed it out, and beckoned me to the bench. I looked over her shoulder as she drew a little box and two parallel lines in front of it. She tapped the box, waved her arm around the cottage, and tapped the box again. This house. She nodded, pointed at the parallel lines, then pointed at the single round window to the left of the front door. The road.
Yes.
She raised a finger to me, attend this, young man, and extended the parallel lines a bit. Then she drew another box. Above it, she wrote YUSEEGOOGIR again. Googir?
Yes.
She patted her mouth, then brought her fingers together rapidly in a snapping crocodile gesture I understood perfectly. Talk.
Yes.
She tapped the non-word, googir. Then she took me by the shoulders. Her hands were strong from her shoe work, the gray fingertips hard with calluses. She turned me and walked me to the front door. When I got there, she pointed at me, made walking gestures with two fingers, and pointed to the right. You want me to go and see the googir? She nodded. My dog needs to rest. She's not in great shape. Dora pointed at Radar, made the sleeping gesture. I thought to ask how far I was supposed to walk, but I doubted if she could answer that kind of question. This would have to be a yes or no type operation. Is it far? Headshake. The googir can talk? That seemed to amuse her, but she nodded. Googir. Does that mean good girl? The crescent smile, a shrug, a nod followed by a shake of the head. I'm kind of lost here. Will I be back before it gets dark? Strong nodding. And you'll keep Radar?
Yes.
I thought about it and decided to give it a try. If the googir could talk, I could get some answers. About Dora and about the city. Googir might even know about the sundial that was supposed to make Radar young again. I decided I'd walk for an hour or so, and if I didn't find the googir's house, I'd turn around and come back. I started to open the door. Instead of a knob, there was an old-fashioned iron latch. She held me by the elbow and raised a finger. Wait one. She hurried back to Shoe Repair Central, pulled out a drawer in the workbench, got something, and hurried back to me. She had three small pieces of leather, less than palm-sized. They looked like shoe soles dyed green. She gestured for me to put them in my pocket.
What are these for?
She frowned, then smiled and turned her hands palms up. Apparently, this was too complicated. She touched the straps of my pack and gave me a questioning look. I decided, what the hell, and slipped it off. I put it beside the door, squatted, opened it, and jammed my wallet into my back pocket, like someone was going to ask me for ID, which was absurd. I looked at Radar as I did it, wondering how she'd take me leaving her with Dora. She raised her head when I stood up and opened the door, then laid it down again, perfectly content to stay where she was and snooze. Why not? Her belly was full of hot food and she was with a friend. There was a walk leading to the wide dirt road, the thoroughfare, lined with poppies. There were other flowers as well, but they were either dying or dead. I turned for a look back. Over the door was a large wooden shoe, bright red like the ones Dora wore. I thought it just about had to be a signboard. She was standing below it, smiling and pointing to the right in case I'd forgotten which way to go in the last minute or so. It was such a mom thing to do that I had to grin.
My name's Charlie Reed, ma'am, and if I didn't say so, thank you for feeding us. It's a pleasure to know you.
She nodded, pointed at me, then patted above her heart. No translation needed for that.
Can I ask one more thing?
She nodded.
Am I speaking your language? I am, aren't I?
She laughed and shrugged. Either she didn't understand, or didn't know, or felt it didn't matter.
Okay, I guess.
Okay.
She went in and shut the door. There was a signboard at the head of the path, like the kind of menu board some restaurants put out on the sidewalk. The side on the right, in the direction I was supposed to go, was blank. A four-line verse was painted on the side facing left, in perfectly understandable English. Give to me your broken shoes, for down the road you'll find ones new. If you place your trust in me, lucky will your journey be. I stood looking at this for much longer than it took to read it. It gave me an idea of where the shoes she was rehabbing came from, but that wasn't why. I knew that printing. I'd seen it on shopping lists and on many envelopes I'd put in the mailbox at 1 Sycamore Street. Mr. Bowditch had made that sign. God knew how many years ago. 5. Walking was easy without the pack, which was good. Looking around for Radar and not seeing her wasn't good, but I was sure she was safe with Dora. I couldn't keep track of the time very well with my phone out of commission, and with the constant overcast, I couldn't even take a rough measure by the sun. It was up there, but only as a dull blob behind the clouds. I decided I'd use the old pioneer way of marking time and distance. I'd go 3 or 4 looks, and if I still saw no sign of the goo gear, I'd turn around and go back. As I walked, I thought about the signboard with the verse on it. A restaurant menu board would have stuff written on both sides, so people could see it both coming and going. This one only had the verse on one side, which suggested to me that traffic on the thoroughfare only went one way, toward the house I was supposed to find. I couldn't understand why that would be, but maybe the googer could tell me, if such a creature actually existed. I had reached the end of my third look, where the road rose and went over a humped wooden bridge, the creek bed beneath it was dry, when I started to hear honking. Not cars, but birds. When I got to the highest point of the bridge, I saw a house on my right. On the left side of the road, there were no more poppies. The woods had swooped right down to the edge. The house was much bigger than the shoe woman's cottage, almost like a ranch house in a TCM Western, and there were outbuildings, two big and one small. The biggest one had to be a barn. This was a farmstead. Behind it was a large garden with neat rows of growing things. I didn't know what all of them were, no horticulturist was I, but I knew corn when I saw it. All the buildings were as old and gray as the shoewoman's skin, but they looked sturdy enough. The honking was coming from geese, at least a dozen of them. They surrounded a woman in a blue dress and a white apron. She held the apron up with one hand, and with the other she was scattering handfuls of feed. The geese went after it greedily, with much flapping of wings. Nearby, eating from a tin trough, was a white horse that looked skinny and old. The word spavined came to mind, but since I didn't know exactly what spavined meant, I had no idea if it was right. There was a butterfly on its head, normal-sized, which was kind of a relief. As I approached, it flew off. She must have seen me from the corner of her eye because she looked up and went still, one hand deep in the pocket of her upheld apron, as the geese jostled and flapped around her feet, honking for more. I also went still, because now I understood what Dora had been trying to convey. Goose girl. But that was only part of the reason I froze. Her hair was a rich, dark blonde with lighter streaks running through it. It fell to her shoulders. Her eyes were wide and blue, the farthest thing from Dora's constant half-erased squint. Her cheeks were rosy. She was young, and not just pretty, she was beautiful. Only one thing marred her storybook loveliness. Between her nose and chin, there was nothing but a knotted white line, like the scar of a serious wound that had healed long since. At the right end of the scar was a dime-sized red blemish that looked like a tiny unopened rose. The goose girl had no mouth. 6. As I came toward her, she took a step toward one of the outbuildings. It might have been a bunkhouse. Two gray-skinned men came out, one holding a pitchfork. I stopped, remembering that I was not only a stranger, I was armed. I raised my empty hands. "I'm okay. Harmless. Dora sent me." The goose girl stood perfectly still for a few moments longer, deciding. Then the hand came out of her apron, and she scattered more corn and grain. With the other hand, she first motioned her farmhands to go back inside, then beckoned me to come ahead. I did, but slowly, still holding my hands up. A trio of geese came flapping and honking toward me, saw my empty hands, and hurried back to the girl. The horse looked around and went back to its lunch. Or maybe it was dinner, because the blob of sun was now moving toward the woods on the far side of the road. The goose girl went on feeding her flock, seemingly unconcerned after her momentary startle. I stood at the edge of her yard, not knowing what to say. It occurred to me that Radar's new friend must have been having me on. I had asked if the googer could talk, and Dora had nodded, but she'd also been smiling. Big joke, send the kid to get answers from a young woman with no mouth. "I'm a stranger here," I said, which was stupid. I'm sure she could see that for herself. It was just that she was so beautiful. In a way, the scar that should have been a mouth and the blemish beside it made her even more beautiful. I'm sure that sounds weird, maybe even perverse, but it was true. "Ouch!" One of the geese had pecked my ankle. That seemed to amuse her. She reached into her apron, brought out the last of the feed, made a tiny fist, and held it out to me. I opened my hand, and she poured a little pile of what looked like wheat mixed with cracked corn into my palm. She used her other hand to hold mine steady, and the touch of her fingers felt like a low electric shock. I was smitten. Any young guy would have been, I think.
I'm here because my dog is old and my friend told me that in the city, I pointed, there was a way to make her young again. I decided to give it a try. I've got about 1,000 questions, but I see you're not, you know, exactly able to. I stopped there, not wanting to dig the hole even deeper, and sprinkled my handful of feed for the geese. I could feel my cheeks burning. This also seemed to amuse her. She dropped her apron and brushed it. The geese gathered around to get the last dusty bits, then headed off toward the barn, clacking and gossiping. The goose girl raised her arms over her head, pulling the fabric of her dress taut against admirable breasts. Yes, I noticed. Sue me. She clapped twice. The old white horse raised its head and ambled toward her. I saw its mane had been braided with bits of colored glass and ribbons. Such decoration suggested to me that it was a she. The next moment I became sure, because when the horse spoke, it was with a female's voice.
I will answer some of your questions because Dora sent you, and because my mistress knows the belt with the pretty blue stones that you wear.
The horse seemed to have no interest in the belt or the holstered 45. She was looking off at the road and the trees on the far side. It was the goose girl who was looking at the concho belt. Then she looked back up at me with those brilliant blue eyes.
Have you come from Adrian?
The voice came from the white horse, in the neighborhood at least, but I could see the muscles moving in the girl's throat and around what had once been her mouth.
You're a ventriloquist, I blurted.
She smiled with her eyes and took my hand. It provoked another of those shocks.
Come.
The goose girl led me around the farmhouse. Chapter 14. Leah and Falada. Help her. A meeting on the road. Wolfies. 2 moons. 1. We only talked for an hour, and I ended up doing most of it, but it was long enough for me to be sure that she was no ordinary farm girl. That probably sounds snobby, as if I don't believe farm girls can be smart or pretty or even beautiful. I don't mean any of those things. I'm sure there are even farm girls somewhere in this great round world of ours who are able to practice ventriloquism. There was something else, something more. She had a certain confidence, an air, as if she were used to having people, and not just farmhands, do her bidding. And after that first hesitation, probably caused by my sudden appearance, she showed absolutely no fear. I probably don't need to tell you that it only took that hour for me to fall head over heels in love with her, either, because you probably already knew it. It's how these stories go, isn't it? Only for me, it was no story. It was my life. It was also Charlie Reed luck, fall for a girl who was not only older, but whose mouth I could never kiss. I would have been glad to kiss the scar where it had been, though, which ought to tell you how bad I had it. One other thing I knew was that, mouth or no mouth, she wasn't meant for the likes of me. She was more than just a girl feeding geese, a lot more. Besides, how much romance can you make when the beautiful girl has to talk to the love-struck Romeo through a horse? But that's what we did. 2. There was a gazebo near the garden. We sat inside at a little round table. A couple of the hands came out of the corn headed for the barn with full baskets, so I guessed it was summer over here instead of early October. The horse cropped grass nearby. A gray girl with a badly deformed face brought a tray and set it down. On it were 2 cloth napkins, a glass, and 2 pitchers, one big and one the size of those teensy pitchers of half and half you get in diners. The big one held what looked like lemonade. The small one contained yellow gluck that might have been pureed squash.
The goose girl motioned for me to pour from the big pitcher and drink. I did so with some embarrassment, because I had a mouth to drink with.
Good,
I said, and it was, just the right mixture of sweet and tart. The gray girl was still standing at the goose girl's shoulder. She pointed at the yellow gluck in the small pitcher. The goose girl nodded, but her nostrils flared in a sigh, and the scar that should have been a mouth pulled down a little. The serving girl took a glass tube from the pocket of a dress that was as gray as her skin. She bent, meaning to push it into the gluck, but the goose girl took the tube and laid it on the table instead. She looked up at the serving girl, nodded, and put her hands together as if saying namaste. The girl returned the nod and left. When she was gone, the goose girl clapped for the horse. She came and hung her head over the rail between us, still chewing her last mouthful.
I'm Falada, the horse said,
but her mouth didn't move the way the dummy's moves as it sits on the ventriloquist's knee. She just kept chewing. I had no idea why the girl was keeping up the voice-throwing charade.
My mistress is Leah.
I later knew the correct spelling, L-E-A-H, thanks to Dora, but what I heard then was L-E-I-A, as in Star Wars. It seemed reasonable enough after everything else that had happened. I'd already met a version of Rumpelstiltskin and an old woman who lived not in a shoe but below the sign of one. I myself was a version of Jack the Beanstalk Boy, and isn't Star Wars just another fairy tale, albeit one with excellent special effects?
It's nice to meet you both, I said.
Of all the strange things that had happened to me that day, stranger things were ahead, that was in many ways the strangest, or maybe I mean the most surreal. I didn't know which one to look at, and ended up swiveling back and forth like someone watching a tennis match.
Did Adrian send you?
Yes, but I knew him as Howard. He was Adrian before. How long since you've seen him? Leah considered this, eyebrows drawn together. Even her frown was pretty. I will try to refrain from such observations from here on, but it will be hard. Then she looked up.
I was much younger, Falada said. Adrian was younger too. He had a dog with him, not much more than a puppy. It danced everywhere. The puppy had a strange name.
Radar.
Yes.
Leah nodded. The horse simply went on chewing, looking disinterested in the whole thing.
Has Adrian passed on? I think if you are here and wearing his belt and weapon, that he has.
Yes.
He decided against another turn on the sundial, then. If so, he was wise.
Yes, he did. I drank some of my lemonade, then put the glass down and leaned forward. I'm here for Radar. She's old now, and I want to take her to this sundial and see if I can... I considered and thought of another science fiction fairy tale, one called Logan's Run, and see if I can renew her. I have questions.
Tell me your story,
Falada said.
I may answer your questions afterward if it seems good to me to do so.
Let me stop here and say I got some information from Leah by way of Falada, but she got a hell of a lot more from me. She had a way about her as if she were used to being obeyed, but it wasn't a mean or bullying way. There are people, well-bred people, who seem to realize they have an obligation to be pleasant and polite, and the obligation is double if they don't have to be. But pleasant or not, they usually get what they want. Because I wanted to be back at Dora's house before dark, I had no idea what might come out of those woods after nightfall, I mostly stuck to my mission. I told her about how I had met Mr. Bowditch, how I'd taken care of him, and how we'd become friends. I told her about the gold and explained that I had enough for now, but in time I might need more in order to keep the well that led to this world secret from people in mine who might misuse it. I didn't bother adding that I'd have to find a way to convert gold to cash now that Mr. Heinrich was dead. Because later, years from now, there will still be taxes to pay, and they're quite high. Do you know what taxes are?
Oh, yes,
Falada said. Right now, though, it's radar I'm worried about. The sundial is in the city, right?
Yes. If you go there, you must be very quiet and follow Adrian's marks. And you must never, never go there at night. You are one of the whole people.
Whole people? She reached over the table to touch my forehead, one cheek, my nose, and my mouth. Her fingers were light, the touch fleeting, but more of those shocks went through me.
Whole, Falada said. Not gray. Not spoiled.
What happened? I asked. Was it got? Her touch wasn't light this time. She slammed her palm against my mouth, hard enough to drive my lips against my teeth. She shook her head.
Never say his name, lest you speed his waking.
She put a hand to her throat, with her fingers touching her jaw on the right side. You're tired, I said. What you're doing to make speech has got to be hard. She nodded. I'll go. Maybe we can talk more tomorrow. I started to get up, but she gestured for me to stay. There was no doubt about the command in that. She raised a finger in a gesture radar would have understood. Down. She put the glass tube in the yellow gluck, then raised the index finger of her right hand to the red blemish, the only flaw in her beautiful skin. I saw that all of her nails, except for the one on that finger, had been trimmed short. She pushed the nail into the blemish until the nail disappeared. She pulled. The flesh opened and a rill of blood ran down from it to her jawline. She inserted the straw in the small hole she'd made, and her cheeks hollowed as she sucked up whatever she took for nourishment. Half of the yellow stuff in the small pitcher disappeared, what would have been for me just a single swallow. Her throat flexed not just once, but several times. It must have tasted as nasty as it looked because she was choking it down. She pulled the straw out of what would have been a tracheotomy incision if it had been in her throat. The hole immediately disappeared. But the blemish looked angrier than ever. It shouted a curse against her beauty. Was that really enough? I sounded appalled. I couldn't help it. You hardly drank any. She nodded in a weary way.
The opening is painful, and the taste is unpleasant after so many years of the same few things. Sometimes I think I'd rather starve. But that would bring too much pleasure in certain quarters.
She tilted her head to the left, in the direction I had come from, and the direction in which the city lay. I'm sorry, I said. If there was anything I could do... She nodded that she understood. Of course people would want to do things for her, they'd fight each other to be first in line, and made the namaste gesture again. Then she picked up one of the napkins and blotted away the trickle of blood. I'd heard of curses. The storybooks are full of them. But this was the first time I'd seen one in action.
Follow his marks, Falada said. Don't get lost, or the night soldiers will have you. And radar.
That must have been a hard one for her, because it came out rayar, making me think of Dora's ecstatic greeting to her.
The sundial is in the stadium plaza, at the rear of the palace. You may accomplish your purpose there if you're quick and quiet. As for the gold you speak of, that is inside. Getting it would be far more dangerous.
Leah, did you once live in that palace?
Long ago, Falada said.
Are you... I had to force myself to say it, although the answer seemed obvious to me. Are you a princess? She bowed her head.
She was.
Leah now referring to herself through Falada in the third person.
The littlest princess of them all. For there were four sisters who were older and two brothers. Princes, if you like. Her sisters are dead. Drusilla, Elena, Joylene, and Falada, my namesake. Robert is dead, for she saw his poor crushed body. Eldon, who was always good to her, is dead. Her mother and father are also dead. Few of her family are left. I was silent, trying to comprehend the enormity of such tragedy. I had lost my mother, and that was bad enough. You must see my mistress's uncle. He lives in the brick house near Seafront Road. He will tell you more. Now my lady is very tired. She bids you good day and safe journey. You must stay the night with Dora. I got up. The blob of sun had almost reached the trees. My mistress wishes you good fortune. She says if you renew Adrian's dog, as you hope, you must bring her here so my mistress can watch her dance and run as she once did. I'll do that. Could I ask one more question? Leah nodded wearily and raised a hand. Say on, but be brief. I took the little leather shoes out of my pocket and showed them to Leah, and then, feeling a bit foolish, to Falada, who showed absolutely zero interest. Dora gave me these, but I don't know what to do with them. Leah smiled with her eyes and stroked Falada's nose.
You may see travelers on your way back to Dora's house. If they are barefooted, they have given broken or worn-out shoes for her to mend. You will see their bare feet and give them those tokens. Down the road this way,
she pointed away from the city,
is a little store, which is owned by Dora's younger brother. If travelers have those tokens, he will give them new shoes.
I considered this. Dora repairs the broken ones. Leah nodded. Then the shoeless people go to her brother, the storekeeper. Leah nodded. When the broken shoes are renewed, like I hope to renew Radar, Dora takes them to her brother. Leah nodded. Does the brother sell them? Leah shook her head. Why not? Stores usually make a profit.
There is more to life than profit, Falada said. My mistress is very tired and must rest now.
Leah took my hand and squeezed it. I don't need to tell you how that made me feel. She released it and clapped a single time. Falada ambled away. One of the gray farmhands came out of the barn and slapped the horse lightly on the flank. She walked toward the barn, willingly enough, the gray man walking beside her. When I looked around, the woman who'd brought the puree and the lemonade was there. She nodded to me and gestured toward the house and the road beyond. The audience, that's what it had been, I had no doubt, was over.
Goodbye, and thank you, I said.
Leah made the namaste gesture, then lowered her head and clasped her hands on her apron. The maid, or perhaps she was a lady-in-waiting, walked with me to the road, her long gray dress brushing the ground.
Can you speak?
I asked her.
Little.
It was a dusty croak.
Hurts.
We reached the thoroughfare. I pointed back the way I'd come.
How far? To the brick house of her uncle, do you know?
She raised a misshapen gray finger. A day? She nodded. The most common form of communication here, I was learning. For those not able to practice ventriloquism, that was. A day to get to the uncle. If it was 20 miles, it might be one day more to the city, more likely two, or even three. Counting the return to the underground corridor leading to the well, maybe 6 days in all, and that was assuming all went okay. By then my father would be back and would have reported me missing. He'd be scared, and he might drink. I'd be gambling my father's sobriety against the life of a dog. And even if the magic sundial existed, who knew if it would work on an elderly German shepherd?
I realized, you'll say I should have before, that what I was thinking of doing wasn't just crazy, it was selfish. If I went back now, no one would be the wiser. Of course, I would have to break out of the shed if Andy had locked it, but I thought I was strong enough to do that. I'd been one of the few players on the Hillview squad who had been able to not just hit a tackling dummy and drive it back a foot or two, but knock it over. And there was something else. I was homesick. I'd only been gone a few hours, but with the day draining to an end in this sad, overcast land where the only real color was the great fields of poppies, yes, I was homesick. I decided to take Radar and go back. Rethink my options, try to make a better plan, one where I could be gone for a week or even two without anyone worrying. I had no idea what such a plan would be, and I think I knew, deep down, in that dark little closet where we try to keep secrets from ourselves, that I would keep putting it off until Radar died. But that was what I meant to do. Until, that was, the Grey Maid took me by the elbow. So far as I could tell from what remained of her face, she was scared to do that, but her grip was firm nonetheless. She pulled me toward her, stood on tiptoe, and whispered to me in her painful croak.
Help her!
3. I walked slowly back to Dora's house of shoes, hardly aware of the declining daylight. I was thinking of how Leah, at that point still thinking of her as L-E-I-A, had opened the blemish beside what had been her mouth. How it had bled. How it must have hurt. But doing it because the pureed gluck was all she could take in to stay alive. When had she last had an ear of corn or a stalk of celery or a bowl of Dora's tasty rabbit stew? Had she been mouthless when Radar was a puppy, gambling around a much younger Falada? Was the beauty that existed in spite of what had to be extreme malnourishment a kind of cruel joke? Was she cursed to look well and healthy in spite of what must be constant hunger? Help her. Was there a way to do that? In a fairy tale, there would be. I remembered my mother reading me the story of Rapunzel when I couldn't have been more than 5. The memory was vivid because of the story's ending. Terrible cruelty reversed by love. A wicked witch punished the prince who rescued Rapunzel by blinding him. I vividly remembered a picture of the poor guy wandering in the dark forest with his arms outstretched to feel for obstacles. Finally, he was reunited with Rapunzel, and her tears restored his sight. Was there a way I could restore Leah's mouth? Probably not by crying on it, true, but maybe there was something I could do. In a world where riding a big sundial backward could peel away the years, anything might be possible. Besides, show me a healthy teenage boy who doesn't want to be the hero of the story, one who helps the beautiful girl, and I'll show you no one at all. As for the possibility that my father might start drinking again, there was something Lindy told me once. You can't take credit for sobering him up because he did that. And if he starts drinking again, you can't take the blame because he'd do that too. I was looking down at my shoes and deep in these thoughts when I heard the squeak of wheels. I looked up and saw a small ramshackle cart coming my way, pulled by a horse so old he made Falada look like the picture of health and youth. There were a few bundles in it with a chicken squatting on top of the biggest. Walking beside it, trudging beside it, was a young man and a young woman. They were gray, but not as gray as Leah's farmhands and maid. If that slate color was a sign of sickness, these people were still in the early stages, and, of course, Leah hadn't been gray at all, just mouthless. It was another mystery. The young man pulled on the horse's reins and stopped him. The couple looked at me with a mixture of fear and hope.
I could read their expressions easily enough, because their faces were mostly there. The woman's eyes had begun to draw up, but they were a long way from becoming the slits through which Dora observed the world. The man was worse. If not for the way his nose appeared to be melting, he might have been handsome.
"Oh,"
he said,
"are we well met? If not, have what you would take. You have a weapon, I have none, and I'm too tired and heartsore to fight you."
"I'm no robber," I said, "just a traveler like you." The woman was wearing short lace-up boots that looked dusty but whole. The man's feet were bare and dirty.
"Are you the one the lady with the dog told us we might meet?"
"That would be me, I guess."
"Have you a token? She said you would, for I gave her the boots I was wearing. They were my father's, and falling to pieces."
"You won't hurt us, will you?"
the young woman asked, but her voice was that of an old woman. Not yet a growl like Dora's, but getting there. These people are cursed, I thought. All of them. And it's a slow curse, which might be the worst kind. "I won't." I took one of the small leather shoe tokens from my pocket and gave it to the young man. He tucked it into his own pocket.
"He'll give my man shoes?"
the woman asked in her growly voice. I answered that question carefully, as befitted a boy whose father worked in the insurance biz. "That was the deal as I understood it."
"We must get on,"
her husband, if that's what he was, said. His voice was a little better, but where I came from, nobody would have given him a job as a TV announcer or audiobook reader.
"We thank you."
From the woods on the far side of the road, a howl arose. It climbed until it was almost a shriek. It was a terrible sound, and the woman shrank against the man.
"Must get on,"
he said again.
"Wolfies."
"Where will you stay?"
"The lady with the dog showed us a picture board and drew what we think was a house and barn. Have you seen it?"
"Yes, and I'm sure they'll take you in. But hurry. And I'll do the same. I don't think being on the road after dark would be cool, was what I thought, but I couldn't say it. It wouldn't be wise." No, because if wolfies came, these two had no house of straw or twigs to hide in, let alone one of bricks. They were strangers in the land. I, at least, had a friend.
"Go on now. I think you'll get new shoes tomorrow. There's a store, or so I was told. The man will give you shoes if you show him your token. I want to ask you a question, if I may."
They waited.
"What is this land? What do you call it?"
They looked at me as if I had a screw loose, a phrase I probably wouldn't be able to say. And then the man replied,
"'Tis Empus."
"Thank you."
They went their way, I went mine, picking up the pace until I was nearly jogging. I heard no more howls, but the gloom of twilight was thick by the time I saw the welcome window glow of Dora's cottage. She had also placed a lamp at the foot of her steps. A shadow moved toward me in the dark, and I dropped my hand to the butt of Mr. Bowditch's .45. The shadow solidified and became radar. I dropped to one knee so she wouldn't stress those bad back legs of hers by trying to jump up, which she was clearly preparing to do. I grabbed her around the neck and pulled her head against my chest.
"Hey, girl, how are you doing?"
Her tail was wagging so hard that her butt swung back and forth like a pendulum. And was I going to let her die if I could do something about it? Bullshit I was. "Help her," Leah's maid had said. And there, on the darkening road, I made up my mind to help them both. The old dog and the goose girl princess. If I could. Radar broke away, went to the poppy field side of the road, and squatted. "Good idea," I said, and unzipped my fly. I kept one hand on the butt of the revolver while I did my thing.
4. Dora had made up a bed for me near the fireplace. There was even a pillow with colorful butterflies on the case. I thanked her, and she dropped me a curtsy. I was amazed to see that her red shoes, like those worn by Dorothy in Oz, had been replaced by a pair of yellow Converse sneakers. "Did Mr. Bowditch give you those?" She nodded and looked down at them with her version of a smile. "Are they your 4 best?" It seemed to me they must be, because they were spandy clean, as if they'd just come out of the box. She nodded, pointed at me, then pointed at the sneakers. "I wore them for you." "Thank you, Dora." Her eyebrows appeared to be melting into her forehead, but she raised what was left of them and pointed in the direction I'd come from.
"Zee?"
"I don't get you." She turned to her workshop and got her little chalkboard. She erased the squares indicating the house and barn she must have showed the young man and woman, then printed in big capital letters, LEAH. She considered this, thinking, then added, ?
"Yes," I said. "The goose girl. I saw her. Thank you for letting us stay the night. Tomorrow, we'll be on our way."
She patted her chest above her heart, pointed to Radar, pointed to me, then raised her hands in an encompassing gesture. "My house is your house." 5. We had more stew, this time accompanied by chunks of rough bread. Rough, but delicious. We ate by candlelight, and Radar got her share. Before I let her have it, I took the bottle of pills from my backpack and sank 2 of them in the gravy. Then, thinking about how far we had to go, I put in a 3rd one. I couldn't get over the idea that, when I was giving them to her, I was robbing Peter to pay Paul. Dora pointed to them and cocked her head.
"They're supposed to help her. We've got a long way to go, and she's not as strong as she used to be."
"She thinks she is, but she isn't."
"When they're gone, I guess."
Another of those drawn-out howls came from the far side of the road. It was joined by another, then a 3rd. They were incredibly loud, rising to screams that made me want to grit my teeth. Radar raised her head but didn't bark, just uttered a faint growl that came from deep in her chest.
"Wolfies," I said.
Dora nodded, crossed her arms over her bosom, and gripped her shoulders. She gave an exaggerated shiver. More wolves joined in. If they kept that up all night, I didn't think I'd be getting much rest before beginning my journey. I don't know if Dora read my mind or it just seemed that way. In either case, she rose and motioned me to come to the round window. She pointed skyward. She was short and didn't have to bend to look up, but I did. What I saw was another shock to my system in a day that had been a steady parade of them. The clouds had parted in a long rift. In the river of sky that was revealed, I could see 2 moons, one bigger than the other. They seemed to race through the void. The big one was very big. I didn't need a telescope to see the craters, valleys, and canyons on its ancient surface. It looked ready to fall on us. Then the rift closed. The wolves stopped howling, and I mean immediately. It was as if they had been broadcasting through a giant amplifier and someone had pulled the plug.
"Does that happen every night?"
She shook her head, spread her hands, then pointed to the clouds. She was good at communicating with her gestures and the few words she could write, but that one escaped me. 6. The only door in the cottage that didn't lead to the back or front was low and Dora-sized. After she had cleaned up our little supper, shooing me away when I tried to help, she went in this door and came out 5 minutes later wearing a nightgown that reached to her bare feet and a kerchief on what remained of her hair. The sneakers were in one hand. She put them carefully, reverently, on a shelf at the head of her bed. There was something else there, and when I asked for a closer look, she held it out to me,
obviously reluctant to hand it over. It was a small, framed photograph of Mr. Bowditch holding a puppy who was obviously Radar. Dora held it to her bosom, patted it, then put it back near the sneakers. She pointed to the little door, then at me. I took my toothbrush and went in. I haven't seen many privies except in books and a few old movies, but I guessed that even if I'd seen a lot, this one would have been the neatest. There was a tin basin of fresh water and a toilet with a closed wooden lid. There were poppies in a wall vase, giving off their sweet smell of cherries. There was no smell of human waste. Zero. I washed my hands and face and dried with a small towel embroidered with more butterflies. I dry-brushed my teeth. I was only in the privy for 5 minutes at most, maybe even not that long, but Dora was fast asleep in her little bed when I came out. Radar was sleeping beside her. I lay on my own makeshift bed, which was a thickness of blankets and a neatly folded one to pull up over me, which I didn't need right then, because the embers in the fireplace were still putting out good heat. Looking at them as they waxed and waned was hypnotic. The wolves were quiet, with no moonlight to crazy them up, but a little wind was playing around the eaves, the sound sometimes rising to a low cry when it gusted, and it was impossible for me not to think of how far I was from my world. Oh, I could reach it again with just a short walk up the hill, a mile down the buried corridor, and 185 spiral steps to the top of the well, but that wasn't the true measure. This was the other land. It was Empus, where not one but two moons raced across the sky. I thought of that book cover, the one showing a funnel filling up with stars. Not stars, I thought. Stories. An endless number of stories that pour into the funnel and come out in our world, barely changed. Then I thought of Mrs. Wilcoxon, my third grade teacher, who ended each day by saying, "What have we learned today, boys and girls?" What had I learned? That this was a place of magic operating under a curse. That the people who lived here were suffering some sort of progressive sickness or disease. I thought I understood now why Dora's sign, the one Mr. Bowditch had printed for her, only needed the shoe poem on the side that faced the abandoned city. It was because people came from that direction. How many, I didn't know, but the blank side of the sign suggested that few, if any, came back. If I assumed the cloud-obscured blob of sun was setting in the west, then the young man and woman I'd met, plus all the rest of the people in the shoe exchange program Dora and her brother were running, were coming from the north. Evacuating from the north? Was it a rolling curse? Maybe even some kind of radiation originating in the city? I didn't have nearly enough information to be sure of that, or even half sure, but it was an unpleasant thought just the same, because that was the way I was planning to go with raids. Would my skin begin to turn gray? Would my voice begin dropping in register toward the growl of Dora and Leah's lady-in-waiting? There had been nothing wrong with Mr. Bowditch's skin and voice, but maybe this part of Empus had been okay, or mostly okay, when he was last here. Maybe this, maybe that. I supposed if I started to see changes in myself, I could turn around and beat feet. Help her. That was what the gray maid had whispered to me. I thought I knew a way to help Radar, but how was I supposed to help a princess with no mouth? In a story, the prince would find a way to do that. It would probably be something unlikely, like Rapunzel's tears turning out to have magical sight-restoring properties, but palatable to readers who wanted a happy ending, even if the teller had to pull one out of his hat. I wasn't a prince anyway, just a high school kid who had found his way into some other reality. And I had no ideas. The embers were their own magic, waxing when the wind swirled down the chimney, waning when the gusts died.
Looking at them, my eyelids seemed to gain weight. I slept, and at some point in the night, Radar crossed the room and lay down beside me. In the morning, the fire was out, but the side of me she was lying against was warm. Chapter 15. Leaving Dora. Refugees. Peterkin. Woody. 1. Breakfast was scrambled eggs, goose eggs by their size, and chunks of bread toasted over a new fire. There was no butter, but there was wonderful strawberry jam. When the meal was finished, I cinched up my pack and put it on. I clipped Radar's leash to her collar. I didn't want her chasing any giant rabbits into the woods and meeting this world's version of a Game of Thrones direwolf. "I'll come back," I told Dora, with more confidence than I felt. I almost added, "And Radar will be young again when I do," but thought that might jinx the deal. Also, I still found the idea of magical regeneration easy to hope for, but harder to believe, even in Empis. "I think I can stay at Leah's uncle's house tonight, assuming he's not allergic to dogs or something. But I'd like to be there before dark." Thinking, it was hard not to, "Wolfies." She nodded, but took my elbow and led me out the back door. The lines still crisscrossed the yard, but the shoes, slippers, and boots had been taken in, presumably so they wouldn't get dampened by the morning dew, which I hoped wasn't radioactive. We went around the side of the cottage, and there was the little cart I'd seen before. The sacks with the greenery poking out of the tops had been replaced by a package wrapped in burlap and tied with twine. Dora pointed at it, then at my mouth. She held a hand in front of her own mouth and opened and closed her partially melted fingers in a chewing gesture. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. "Geez, no, I can't take your food, and I can't take your cart. Isn't that how you take the shoes you mend to your brother's store?" She pointed to Radar and made a number of limping steps